Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host today. It's Saturday, August 21st, 2010. Excuse me. And we are in the midst of the approximate two-month time period identified by Lyndon LaRouche back in mid-July as the time during which we must have a decisive break with the imperialist monetary system of the British Empire, or we will be plunged into a 1923 Weimar-style hyperinflation, which will destroy human civilization for the next several generations. In the last week, we saw two things happen. One, the confirmation of the accuracy of LaRouche's forecast with the decision made by the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department to go with what is now universally acknowledged as a hyperinflationary policy. That is, they're not wiping out the bad debts, they're not reorganizing the banking system, they're not going with a Glass-Steagall, they are creating funny money in huge volumes and pumping it into the banking system at the expense of the physical economy. But in response to that, and the sense of urgency in LaRouche's forecast, there was a specific means by which this break can be made, which has been under development. And on today's program, we will be discussing the revolution in the self-identity of man, which emerged from the work done in the basement as of last night. I'm talking about the broad outline of NAWAPA, the North American Water and Power Alliance. That is, NAWAPA in its true form, not simply as an infrastructure program or a jobs plan, although it is both, but as it was envisioned by LaRouche, as the means by which mankind self-consciously asserts its authority over the biosphere, at the same time moving into space. This project was posted last night on the website, the LaRouche PAC website, and joining me today to discuss this will be two members of the basement team that were involved in making this revolution, getting it done on time, and have quite a bit to say about how we're going to succeed in waging this fight. So joining me will be Merv Fansler and Michael Kirsch from the basement. I believe you're both there, Michael and Merv.
I'm here as Merv.
Michael.
Okay, good. Well,
we're working together.
Yes. Well, that's the point Mr. LaRouche made this morning, that it was a collaboration. It was the kind of thing that boomers have not done in the organization for a very long time, but he had some very interesting comments this morning about this, his thoughts on the completion of this phase of the operation with the posting of the NAWAPA tour on the LaRouche PAC website. Michael, why don't we open with you giving us a sense of what Mr. LaRouche had to say this morning?
Well, he said that we have now done a job which has a chance of giving us, it has given us the opportunity to have a chance to save civilization. And that what you do in strategy is you choose the impossible and then you carry that out.
Now
the long and short of...
Go ahead.
That's the summary of what he said this morning. Because putting this forward as a concept which is real, it's real. It's a concept that can now move and inspire the United States and the rest of the world to carry out these types of projects.
What I'd like to do is start by talking about what was posted and then what that demonstrates or shows in terms of the idea, and I mean the idea of NAWAPA. So, Merv, I know you were very much involved, probably into the wee hours this morning, in making sure this thing was posted. What is it that we now have on the LaRouche PAC website on NAWAPA?
Well, what we wanted to put together as just the first attempt to get the concept out there to start teasing people with it was to take the NAWAPA project, the North American Water and Power Alliance, which was originally proposed by the Ralph M. Parsons company back in 1964, and they had been working on it for, I guess, since 1962 or so. They had been developing a concept of how that they faced the fact that there was no way that you could solve the water crisis that was apparent from the direction in which the United States was going to develop, not just the United States, but Mexico and Canada, that there were going to be water demands which were impossible to be met if we were just going to continue to focus on regional solutions and local solutions, that there was actually no way in which you could conceive of a local solution which would last, which would actually mean successful survival. You might be able to ensure momentary survival for your town or city for another 5 to 10 years for each project, but there was no way that you could get a total vision of the project. There was no way you could resolve the fundamental issues until you started thinking on a continental level. And so they proposed the North American Water Power Alliance to bring down water from the Northwest, this huge Pacific runoff area that Alaska and the Yukon and British Columbia territories of Canada lie in, where this water precipitation occurs. So what we did was we took their project and, you know, dug through all of their maps, everything that they had on it that we could find, and we made some provisional maps, and in particular in a 3D interactive map that people can, we did tours for it, so there's tours through, narrated tours that walk you through some of the principal functionality of the project, and sort of pose some of the fundamental problems that we'll probably discuss some more today. And then also, it's fully interactive, so people can explore the magnitude of this thing. The reason why you need the 3D interactive map is because you really can't. I mean, the NWAPA project itself is not something you can perceive. If you tried to perceive it, you'd have to go to space, because that's the only way you could see the entire thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, Merv, when you say that we went back to the Parsons plan, I know that in the early 60s there was a video that they had produced. There were a number of papers. There was even a study commissioned by the Congress. And this was picked back up in the late 70s, early 80s by Lyndon LaRouche. In fact, we had a major conference here in Houston, Texas, I believe in 1981, which included former Senator Frank Moss, who was one of the sponsors of the congressional side of it. But what we did was we had to go back to these old documents, back to the last century, so to speak. There's not been much done on this in recent years, has there?
No, not at all. I mean, essentially what happened was, and I know this is what, I mean, we were going in, that the LaRouche organization in the 1970s and 80s was going directly against, was this, was there was an sort of the no-growth, zero technology movement that was saying, you know, we're gonna exhaust all of our resources in 20 years. Everybody's going to be wiped out. We have to stop growing technologically. And what happened after NWAPA? I mean, immediately as NWAPA was getting this motion that you were discussing in the Congress, and studies were being done, was that a lot of the key territories that were supposed to be developed, that were going to be completely transformed, they were going to be the crucial sort of pivotal points of the project. A lot of funding went into closing all these things off, sort of Teddy Roosevelt style, and saying, no, this river, you can't even, it's illegal for the government now to even do a feasibility study of building a dam there. You can't even bring a motor, you know, anywhere near these areas. I mean, you there is no, it's like a zero technology law which exists on a lot of these that was put into place. And a lot of it was, you know, it was funded through different British networks like the World Wildlife Foundation and things like that. Mm-hmm. That were going into to stop the US from developing. Mm-hmm. And you know, you look at it's striking. You said, you know, no one's looking at these things today. It's striking when we went back to the reports and you look at the projections of where they say the United States should be in terms of energy consumption, mm-hmm. Water consumption, what we should, the state of technology, and the state of like the magnitude of our economy, where it should be if we would have continued on the same path that, you know, that sort of Kennedy era, that trajectory where it was headed going to the moon. And, you know, we've absolutely, compared to where we should be, we've collapsed. I mean, the only reason why we exist today is because we kept destroying all the industries that used water. I mean, and there's still water. There's tremendous water crises all over the place. Mm-hmm. So, but that, you know, you look at where it was, where we were going, and it's sort of striking because there was a sense that we were going to continue to develop, and you look at where we are today, and it's nowhere near where the projections were.
Well, this is the same thing if you go back to the idea that Lincoln and his allies had coming out of the Civil War, where they projected the Transcontinental Railroad would allow for massive development of the Western states, that this would be the true realization of a continental nation. And, of course, this is why Teddy Roosevelt was brought in, to destroy the Lincoln revival of the American system economically and also in terms of that continent-wide development. So we've seen this kind of thing before. Now, Michael, I'd like your thoughts on the difference that is behind the thinking of the way LaRouche is approaching it and the otherwise commendable but still somewhat limited thinking of the people during the Kennedy era who had an idea of the destiny of going into space and who definitely thought big. But what's the difference that Lyndon LaRouche has brought to this?
Well, the difference is that mankind doesn't objectively observe the wildlife in the different areas of the country, of the continent. But mankind is part of a whole process of continuing what the biosphere has done for estimated 4 billion years of shaping the whole continent, and continuing that process in a way which now what you have a sense of is that you're controlling and regulating a system, and now the things that are happening within that system are now they're happening with an ability to carry out essentially experiments in which the principle of cognition can see what's happening on the biosphere and the abiotic levels, because you're creating a whole continental management system, which is regulating the let's say in this case we're plugging ourselves into the water cycle, but now we're creating this regulated environment in which the things which naturally would just sort of objectively be observed as, you know, a person going out describing things in the woods, well, now you're creating that system. And so how that system operates in terms of the weather, in terms of migration patterns of animals, in terms of the different resources that exist in the northern part of the earth, in Canada and Russia, we're looking at all of those things now existing within the bounds of a cognitive organization. Mm-hmm. And so it's a real sense that, you know, we're not accidentally sort of having to abide by any one local region. And that's really what the issue of the nation, the point of the nation is. You know, one of the people who wrote about during the time of the TVA was confronted with the fact that the Supreme Court was sort of, you know, they would find that watersheds are illegal because watersheds, you know, naturally cross state lines, right? And you find that there's nothing. He was pointing out there's nothing in the original Constitution that really took into this sort of water basin management, but that instead you are looking at then. What he was saying was comes up in the original TVA was a realization that Yeah, this type of regional management is not. This is the purpose of the nation, right? You're organizing things that cross state lines for an overall principle and upshift of the human species. You know, and was just referenced by Merv and by you that, you know, we've done these things, and then we get set back. We do these things, we get set back.
Well, Michael, let me ask you this, because what you're bringing up, I think, is a profound point, and this is something that's not just implicit but absolutely explicit in what LaRouche is talking about, which is the application of the scientific ideas of Vladimir Vernadsky. And I think that what I'd like to know if you think there was any indication in either the Franklin Roosevelt or the Kennedy era of any indication that people were guided by this, or did they just have a certain kind of embedded American instinct? And therefore, if that is all they had, we now actually are entering an era where there's a willful, voluntary decision by man to transform the biosphere. Would that be accurate from the work that you're doing to say that is a difference?
Well, I think it's definitely there. There are people that we're looking into now that, you know, we're looking at this in terms of managing the entire continent and its resources in the TVA and making the case that on the law books, yeah, it was a question of navigation canals, making sure they didn't flood. Therefore, you got to realize you're going to have dams. You're going to have to do all these things that go along with this. And in the law book, all you say is you're building a navigation canal. But there were people that were realizing what they were doing as they were setting up the whole system. The difference here is really what Lyndon LaRouche is putting forward is that this is that when you're thinking of NWAPA, you are really thinking of the Earth in space. And as Merv said, you know, you can't really even sense perceptually see this thing. There's no way it's so. And so it is a space program, because we're talking about the kind of scale we're going to have to be thinking about of managing Mars. And initially what you're doing here is you're going to be regulating the use of chlorophyll, right, and you extend that to how you're going to change weather patterns based on the fact that this water is going to be multiplied in its use, which is something people had a very good sense of in the TVA as well.
Yeah, right.
But now you're having a sense that we want to start looking at weather as something that mankind itself is regulating and controlling all the way out to Mars, and taking the Earth's magnetosphere, the Earth's interaction with cosmic radiation, and what you have down at NOAA, looking at space weather. We want to look not at just us observing space weather, but we want to look at being able to control the effects of the sun and the Earth's orbit, not necessarily changing the sun or the Earth's orbit, but controlling the effects from the Earth all the way out to Mars, the magnetic fields involved and the weather patterns involved, how the whole water cycle and plants and life, and really just because we want to manage and organize the whole solar system. So we start here with the continent, and you look at NWAPA, go through these tours, look at this interactive map. You can pause them at any time, and you can zoom in, move around, and restart the tour, and just really go step by step through this thing. We'll have more material as we add to this, but you start to realize what it means to start thinking about not just this dam and this river, my local industry here, but what it is, this view of how the whole system can be tapped into. And that's really what you're saying. That's where the Vernadsky becomes very important. You start to look at this thing from the lawful scientific view versus local projects, water rights, regional state issues.
Or even there are people who might put forward a national employment perspective or something like that. But I just want to remind people they're listening to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, August 21st, 2010. This was the D-Day. This was the target date to get the NWAPA map and the related materials up on the LaRouche PAC website. It was accomplished. It was a collaborative effort of a group of young people operating in the basement. And if you have some questions for Merv or Michael, you can send them to us at radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. Now, just to follow up with what Michael was saying, Merv, about 3 weeks ago when we started moving more aggressively into this perspective, Cody Jones, who's one of your colleagues, was on the program, and he described this as an identity shift for mankind. And in a sense, this is, I would assume this identity shift includes the idea of the extraterrestrial imperative, as Michael was just discussing it. How do you see this, Merv? When you think about why people should be excited about this, what is it we're saying about this time in history? You have a crisis, but that we can't just do crisis management or try to dig our way out of the crisis, but need something totally new. Is that a useful way to look at it?
Definitely. I think just to step back and look at the question in a sort of, I guess, a broad way, is that, I mean, mankind, we develop ideas about the nature of the universe, not just individually, but sort of as how we as men interface and interact with the sort of the universe in which we're situated. And we develop conceptions about how, like, what our role is in that. And a lot of, for the most part, I mean, through the history of mankind, it's been, I mean, it's like a child. A child has a sense of, how does a child have a sense of, like, another person or a principle or the things that, you know, the things that the child needs? You know, the child knows it need, you know, that he or she needs food or things like this. But when you're a young child, I mean, a lot of times you just have, like, you think of all these things as objects, which you need. And the larger conception of, you know, the process which makes everything possible, and the fact that that these things that you need are actually taking you somewhere. When you're a child and you're, like, going to school, I mean, not everybody's experience in school is the greatest, but, you know, at first you don't really get a sense of, like, that you're going somewhere to do something, that you're here for a purpose, and that you're developing yourself to actually contribute something to future generations. And it's true, I think, it's true not just on that sort of personal, individualistic level, but it's true on the level of mankind, humanity as a whole, that, you know, when you have these people who are discussing the WAPA or things like this, they're beginning to have concepts of, well, these are important things that we need them, but it still hasn't approached a level of sort of self-consciousness about the principles which are determining the development of the universe, and the fact that we actually manage them. And I think that's where the Vernadsky conception comes in, that Vernadsky is discussing, saying, look, there's not, all we know about the universe is that it changes, and it's constantly changing. There might be, like, cycles, like seasonal cycles, or the earth going around the sun, or, you know, your heart beating, but every time, you know, any of those sub-cycles occurs, there's something, the universe has developed. It's moving somewhere. It's going somewhere. And Vernadsky's conception was that you could see that there were clearly three, like, well-defined phase spaces in which the universe was that are interacting, that comprise that creativity in the that development of the universe, that it's not just some cyclical process, but it's actually going somewhere. And I think what the NWAPA is for, in LaRouche's mind, and what we need, what we're getting at now, is it is to begin to communicate to people that we actually have a mankind is at a point where it must begin to have a self-conscious conception of developing the universe, and that's why it's a space program, because you know that's we live in a solar system which we know has been developing, and a bio you know that created the Earth, and then a biosphere evolved on that, in which you know we've it's sort of like our womb, but now it's time for us to begin to expand that development process out into the rest of the solar system, and there's a lawful principle involved with us actually becoming conscious of that.
Well, now this is an important point that I want to get at, because a lot of our listeners are out there saying, well, yeah, I kind of like NWAPA. It sounds like a good idea. I sort of get what you're saying, but shouldn't we just go out and sell this as a jobs program? Because under Obama, we've seen a collapse of employment. Actually, under the last 40 years, we've seen a collapse of productive employment. People who studied to be scientists and engineers are now finding no work. You know, we're shutting down the space program. Many of these construction companies and hydraulic firms that hire hydraulic engineers, they've had massive cutbacks, bankruptcies, and so on. So wouldn't it be best to just be practical and sell it as a jobs program, as something that will maybe turn around the collapse? But that's not the way we're approaching it. So either Merv or Michael...
No, not at all. That's exactly what that is, like the infantile way, yeah, to think about these effects that you actually turn, you know, people want to turn jobs into an actual substantial object rather than just being an effect in a process.
Mm-hmm.
And until we can have this much higher top-down conception of, I mean, a job is a singularity in a process. It's not an object.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people just want to like latch on to these things and say, well, we need these objects, mm-hmm, right? It's like, I need money, you know, because
yeah,
money represents for people, it's the means by which they can get all the things that they, like they you know, that they need to eat, right? And they need to have a home to live in. So money represents an object, but it becomes an object, and they lose the conception of the actual process which is involved of the creation of an economy in which they can exist.
And I think this is the identity shift that we're actually talking about. And Michael, you and I had a discussion some time ago about this question of, you know, are some people more oriented toward a scientific outlook than others? Can you really move a population to start thinking more in terms of science and discovery? And how do you do that?
Well, this is what the United States was intended to be, because this is what the freedom of self-government, really, this is what it's about. It's never been about this silly, I just want to have the right to make property or something. And the United States, if you look at every time we've had anybody that's held to the Constitution and the people who formed the Constitution, that's what we've been doing. We built the initial Army Corps, was starting to move, build canals, rivers, started managing the territory. JQA started the railroad development, started the different mining industries.
John Quincy Adams.
John Quincy Adams, yeah.
For those who didn't get the acronym.
Oh, sorry, yeah. John Quincy Adams, the 1820s and 1830s.
Yeah.
And then we carried that forward when we finally got free of a bunch of muck. And we finally carried that out with the Transcontinental Railroad. And this was the fight in Europe with Leibniz earlier before that. And even before in getting technology applied throughout a region. But without the sovereign nation state, that wasn't a feasible thing because of this. It really is, yeah, this struggle of fight of mankind. It's typified by the whole Zeus versus Prometheus concept.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, this is this is the what United States. We're not just trying to fix some bridges. We're not just trying to repair broken infrastructure or something and put people to work. And people who worked in the Roosevelt administration had a sense of this of this as well. I mean, there's a purpose and intention for why what the next step you want to do as you're looking at the whole continent. And so I think people have been demoralized, and they may want to latch on to anything. What we're doing here is slightly, if not entirely different. What we're doing here now is we want to connect and bridge the gap that has been created by the baby boomer generation since 1968 to the present. And we're going to reach back to the skilled and engineering workforce that is laid off and or too old to work, and we're going to tap into that knowledge with now a reinvigorated sense and a unique sense of this arc of scientific and artistic development all the way, which Lyndon LaRouche has built with this political movement since the late 60s. And then we're going to connect the new generation to the past with an initial CCC effort, total transformation of the economy. But yes, for this much bigger purpose. But I just stress that, people who are listening, we are going to organize this a nationwide force to put this thing as a real concept, and I stress that on every level that we're talking about it.
And I think Michael, what you're saying is that everyone who's listening should not just be consuming this and say, oh, that sounds interesting, but the reason the project was done to put it up on the website was to give you the means by which you, the listener, can take this revolutionary conception from LaRouche and organize people in your neighborhood, in your community, in your barbecue club to get these ideas out. So what I'd like to do, Merv, is if you can just take us through a little bit of what people will find when they go there, what they need to know when they first log on, what are they going to see, and how do they use it?
Well, when you get to the website, I think we have it right now. It's like the top icon in the center on our website is a link to the interactive map. And you'll need, there's certain, just like operating system requirements. I think, you have to have Windows or Macintosh. And then you might need to download the plugin to run the program, basically download the program to be able to view the map in your browser. But then once you have that and it loads up, then you'll get four, the Earth will, you have a picture of the Earth, and you can turn it around. You can use your mouse to turn it around and zoom in and see all the development. Then below that, you'll have a list of sort of four tours that we've put together, and you can just click on one of those. And we recommend just watching the four in a row. Watch them in succession. And you can watch it. If there's a part that's not clear, you can pause it, or you can move back and listen to it again, or you can pause it and you can look at when you pause the tour, you can actually go and look around and zoom in on a dam if it wasn't clear, and even click on some of the dams, and it'll give you information about more specific information about what the size of it's going to be, or if it's a hydroelectric dam, what the amount of power it might be producing, or the amount of power, if it's a lift, the amount of power that's going to be required to, pump up the water to a certain extent. But it follows, so if you follow the tours through, there's an overview that gives you a general sense of what the NOAAPA program is, and then there's three tours that will bring you through. First, the collection area, which is this Alaska, and then the western half of, and the western third of Canada and the Yukon Territory in British Columbia, and then down into the what's called the transfer area, or coming out of the Rocky Mountain Trench, which is in the collection area, and is in British Columbia. You'll have a transfer area along Montana, Idaho, Washington, they in the Northwest, there are border states with Canada. The water will be transferred in to those states and then brought down. There is where the brunt in Idaho and Montana is the brunt of the energy consumption for the thing, for the project. Because there we're going to lift the water to get it out of this Columbia River basin. You have to lift the water thousands of feet, literally, and to bring it over out of that river basin and into the southern river basins and the Pacific River basin. But then that transfer section. So there's a video that'll go through the transfer section and how that's accomplished. And then there's a third video that then goes through the amazing distribution section. And one of the things which I think is just, I mean, phenomenal to think about the level of irrigated land that we would have once the Nawapa has reached full capacity. It's a decades-long project to actually get to full capacity. But once you reach that, the level of irrigated, the amount of irrigated land that you would create out of, you know, arid, semi-arid regions currently would be comparable with actually a little more than half the entire size of California, which is, you know, it's huge. I mean, it's a phenomenal amount of land that you would create. To the scale that it's going to transform the biosphere as a whole.
Well, I'd like to get into that in a specific way, because I just flew back from Los Angeles to Houston, as I've done for the last 16 years, you know, almost every other week. And of course, most of the time, once you leave the Los Angeles basin and cross the first round of the mountains there, until you reach San Antonio, you have nothing but desert. You have a couple of areas where you see a few patches of green where there's irrigation. Of course, Phoenix, where you have a lot of green golf courses. But other than that, mostly what you see is desert. Now, Michael, what's the effect? And of course, the environmentalists who call themselves greenies, but I think someone made the joke on the Off the Cuff the other night, they should be called brownies, because, in fact, they seem to like the desert. What's the effect on the biosphere of this scale of irrigation and expansion of water? What's that going to do to the planet?
Well, it's going to change it into a noosphere, I think. Because the one reference that in the distribution tour that one of our associates made was, these rivers here aren't doing much by themselves. You have large rivers running through the middle of deserts, and they don't seem to be, you know, very active. But in a sense, it is going to be turning the whole biosphere into a noosphere, because it's all a regulated environment. But this time, it's going to be for a much bigger purpose. But I think, and what you're asking is some of the ratios and amounts of water we're bringing into the area.
Mm-hmm.
It's 70 million acre feet, which is through the distribution section. There's a total of 110 million acre feet that's available for distribution as a whole, but 70 million acre feet go down in there. And as Merv just said, I mean, it's half of the almost half of the area of California becomes now green. And so, as people can find, still featured on the LaRouche PAC website, Nawapa. I think from the standpoint of the biosphere, it's called, goes through how, you know, what we're doing is plugging ourselves into this normal water cycle, which happens on both the east and west coasts of the Pacific Ocean, Atlantic Ocean water. You know, the law of nature, what goes up must come down. And it's going to come down in the form of rain, in fresh water. But if you don't have dams and regulation systems for erosion, you're going to get flooding, you're going to get silt in your reservoirs and canals, and what we're tapping into is all of that now, as basically utilizing that resource, which is otherwise just either flooding through this desert, which gets flooded once in a while, or running off into the ocean. And it's going to, I mean, it's going to have effects which really we're not going to know until we figure them out. There is some analysis that can be done, and we're going to be creating as we go here in discussions with people out there, maybe some of you listening, and other people around the country, exactly what kind of effect this is going to have. First, we've got this map, but what we want to really get in a dialogue with across the country is exactly how this transformation is going to be occurring, both in terms of where the rail is going to be laid, where the industries to build this stuff is going to be set up, where the cities to support those industries are going to set up, where we're going to need nuclear power. For all the agriculture, we're going to need lots of power, right? For all of the fertilizer and related things, and exactly how this is going to begin changing the water cycle, we can also map that out. All of this stuff and the specifics of the transformation, and then being able to really look at it as a system, as we've been studying with this concept of the tensor, and become develop a real more science of economy, conscious understanding of what the transformation will take place, rather than it just sort of happening to everybody. Something we're going to be doing.
I think we can say, from what you just described, that the science of the thing is either relatively predictable, or it will create the opportunity for us to make new hypotheses to solve problems, but it's doable. The bigger question then comes up for a lot of Americans who have been crushed by this cynical baby boomer culture, who say, well, it'll never happen. We'll never do it. Congress will never vote the funds. And I think this is where, again, we see something very interesting from the kind of political strategy outlined by Lyndon LaRouche, namely that to get this, we're going to have to remove President Obama, because he represents, in a sense, the force of the British Empire that is doing everything possible to make sure the United States has no way out of this crisis. And I'm just wondering.
What he said today,
what
he said today is exactly that the only way you're going to get Obama out is by having this alternative.
Exactly.
Because without having an alternative that is not simply pie in the sky, but is every step of the way. And that's why in the coming weeks, we want to have a discussion with people of how this thing is going to work more. I just forgot what I was going to say, but what you were just bringing up. I mean, that we want to have this thing as such a real and thought through idea that people are not going to tolerate this clown in there.
Well,
we're forecasting the
right.
recovery here.
Right.
And to do that. And as you say, the cynical people who've seen that this hasn't happened, that's why what we're going to do is it's not simply talking to this guy and he agrees, but I don't see how it's going to happen, and then I talk to this guy and I know that sounds great, but I don't see how it's going to happen. What we have to essentially echo of the Roosevelt and Vernadsky Institutes is that this is going to be a unified program. And we're orchestrating this unified program, and I can tell everybody now that we will do this because we are going to organize it to be done. We're not putting a bill in and hope it gets passed.
Well, I would say that, just to put it slightly different, the way the three campaigns of the LaRouche candidates, Rachel Brown in Boston, Massachusetts, running against the despicable Barney Frank, Keisha Rogers down here in the 22nd District of Texas, who is the Democratic nominee, and then the flagship for NUAPA is the Summer Shields campaign out in San Francisco. He's not only running against Pelosi, but he's running a campaign to bring back dignity to the people of San Francisco. The way the three campaigns are approaching this is to say that here's what we could do in the post-Obama era, and get people inspired by that to then say, okay, now what's the problem? Well, we don't have Obama out yet. So let's get him out so we can do this. And I think that functions the way you were just describing. You give people a something that would make them happy and something that would be a mission worth fighting for, because otherwise the tendency is to sit around and whine and mope and forget that we're humans. And instead,
yeah, well, we're allocating our resources and people. I wouldn't say it's really a political risk, but some people say think of things as political risk, whether they're going to go out for something. And the clear, the more real and clear and undeniably necessary as an upshift of mankind's destiny and something that's feasible, that then it's worth taking that risk. That yes, okay, I'm gonna go all out for this.
Well, we do have an email from one of our contacts, one of our listeners, not exactly on this topic, but it actually is on this topic. He asked some questions about creative destruction. You know, that we're looking into this, the fact that the fascist economist Schumpeter, and of course you can call him a fascist because these are the ideas that were part of the Nazi outlook. But the idea that you have to destroy an economy, you have to destroy the ideas of an economy in order to have innovation, that we discovered in the last couple of weeks that people like Greenspan, Larry Summers, all the top people who have shaped the current economic climate in the United States represent creative destruction. Now, in a certain sense, someone might argue, if they were a literalist, well, don't you have to create new ideas, which means get rid of the old ideas. But Merv, I'd like you just to comment a little bit about what actually is this process, because we were talking earlier about how what we're reviving in the idea of a nation are ideas that go back to Kuza and Kepler and Leibniz. And in a sense, the difference between that development on the backs of those kinds of geniuses as opposed to this idea of creative destruction. I wonder if you have some thoughts about that, Merv.
Well, I think it's best represented by this. I mean, the real difference in thought is, I mean, the only thing we need to destroy is the idea of creative destruction. I mean, it's because it's at the heart of the imperialistic mindset, and it's what has driven and created the basis for, you know, imperialism to exist and expand and control the way that people think. And it's done by this, these conceptions force people to not think about what really is the nature of man and how they should be thinking. It's not in this, you know, Apollonian, Dionysian creative destruction, but instead it's a conception of Prometheus against Zeus. You know, Zeus in the form of the oligarchy and the Apollo, you know, Dionysian cult, you know, that was deployed to destroy the concepts that had developed out of the most noble Greek thinkers, who had a concept of man as immortal, as man as is discovering new principles and bringing new principles in under their control.
It's the idea that immortality comes from the creative mind, not from a birth line.
Yeah, exactly.
I would also say that in your using what you were saying, Zeus was the first major practitioner of creative destruction.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing is, all these guys, it's just scientifically incompetent. I mean, it's just a bunch of schmucks who are incompetent and controlled politically top down. Mm-hmm. But all the arguments of anything, any kind of economy that begins with fixed cycles, money, deterministic ideas, I mean, it's all just, frankly, just scientifically refutable and absurd. And all the real scientists in history and, all the real scientists in history, their work has refuted and the Sarpi Newtonian model and everything that's based on it, you know, 10 times.
Mm-hmm.
So well, it's
Michael, that brings us to this other point, which is that if you look at the two major arguments against NWAPA, one is, of course, we've already exposed is the phony environmentalism. But you're just now talking about the other one, which is, well, we can't afford it. We don't have enough money. We can't do it. And, of course, this is coming from people who just spent $24 trillion to bail out a bunch of swindlers who ran up the bill against the American people on collateralized debt obligations and things of that sort.
Yeah.
What is the financial argument as to why we have to do this?
Yeah, I mean, first let me just say, I will come back to that, but, you know, anybody who presents any of this stuff, just tell them to shove it. and tell them that, you know, tell them to present a scientifically valid study that shows, you know, that you can't do this. But secondly, the fact that we didn't do it in 1964, you know, if you want to talk about it in this way, has already cost probably 4 to 5 times the initial $100 billion in the problems of the water crisis, agriculture, and everything else. And so that's really all there. I mean, that's all you have to say to that. But the other thing is, yeah, I mean, money is not the measure of anything, nor is there a finite amount of it. It's something that's controlled through the will of governments. So when you think about this from the standpoint of real competent science, which starts from the fact that our economy is about human economy and the humans and their minds that are in sovereign economies, then you just start from there. I mean, all this other stuff is politically motivated garbage, and if somebody kind of wants to put it forward, you just tell them to look at LaRouche's record and ask them to put forward a real plan that would say why they are proposing what they're proposing, and I'll look it over and get back to them.
Well, Michael, it also goes back to something that's near and dear to your heart, which is the Hamiltonian conception of credit, which is connected to physical economy as opposed to an imperial system of a circulation of money and making people stupid because of their thinking that an economy is about grabbing money.
Yeah, and the original people who said $100 billion is too, you know, that wasn't the reason why NWAPA didn't happen. But, yeah, I mean, the credit is, this stuff is, they just don't really know the Constitution. We don't have to sell bonds on the market and raise money on the financial markets through the Federal Reserve. I mean, money, that's why I said money's not a measure of anything.
Right.
This stuff is all controlled. This is why we need the Glass-Steagall Act. But we want to push this, and we want to inspire the necessity to remove Obama. Then we'll reinstate the credit system with the Glass-Steagall Act, and we'll have no problem in funding any of these things. The problem will be right now is the capability to do it, which is what we want to map out this next week. We're going to map this out. And that will define for us the timeline, the time scale, the scheduling of this, the number of people we have available to put to work in different regions.
So that's where we're going next? That's what people have to look forward to on the site coming up?
That's what people should help us do.
Aha.
And then they can look forward to it.
Well, we have one of the things we did stir up in our listeners is we have about a couple of emails here asking about, all right, so how do we get Obama out? And I think both of you have addressed this, but if you could think one more time about the person who's sitting there saying, it sounds good, but how do we get Obama out? Either of you, what would you say?
I'd say organize for NWAPA. I mean, it's only when you get it's only when you get this self-conscious conception in the individuals in the society that you're gonna have a society that can actually think and function. If you organize for that, then the other things will fall into place. And the political goons, you know, they go along with whatever. They have inclinations. There's people that have inclinations to do the right thing or whatever. But, you know, a lot of these people are just sellouts, and they're going to do whatever whatever is moving the population. And so now the task now is to create this concept to sort of invigorate this concept in people's minds.
Well, I think, and also let me just add, Lyndon LaRouche has made the point over and over and over that Obama is heartily disliked by the vast majority of the population. They may not always say that publicly, but we see it show up in polls of people thinking this is the country's going in the wrong direction and so on. So I think the question is a somewhat false question, how do we get Obama out? Because it's largely coming from people who are sitting on the sideline waiting for something to happen.
Yeah,
I'll,
right.
I'll give you an informal indication, an anecdote about this. In Obama now is on his 37th vacation of the last 38 days. He's, you know, he's up in Martha's Vineyard. And the, in the last year when he was there, they couldn't sell, they couldn't get enough T-shirts to sell because everyone wanted T-shirts with pictures of Obama saying, I vacationed with Obama. This year they stocked the stores with them again, and no one's buying them. You know what by far the most popular T-shirt being sold in Martha's Vineyard is right now? A T-shirt with a picture of George W. Bush with a characteristic shit-eating grin on his face that says, miss me yet?
Oh, my God.
Now, that tells you something.
I mean, if you don't,
That tells you something about the shit. Go ahead,
sorry. If people don't have the self-dignity yet to say that Obama has to go, look into this NWAPA thing, and you realize that you deserve better than a British agent who's done everything to sabotage everything for national interest since he's been in there.
And I think that's all we have to say on that topic, that people with that kind of self-dignity have to have enough confidence in their ability to think and their ability to communicate ideas that you're not afraid to go out and organize people to see this as an alternative. We just have a little more than 2 minutes to go. Merv, do you want to say something to sort of summarize the importance of what we've done and what people should do?
Well, I just encourage people to. I mean, we got to move. You know, LaRouche has emphasized he's been really kicking our butts to get this thing moving, and we're operating on a 24-hour, 7 days a week basis. Pretty much right now, and we got to get everybody that we can, everybody that's listening, to deploy with this immediately, and just fire away. This is a sort of a blitz period. We got to get it done.
And Michael,
and we're declaring World War III with this.
Well, and I think the it's obvious to anybody who's paying attention that the decisions made in the last couple of weeks by the Treasury Department, the Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, that they are pushing us exactly as LaRouche warned into a Weimar-style hyperinflation. And it's sort of like you're sitting in a room filled with gasoline and you're hoping no one's going to light a match. And the fact that no one's lit a match yet, you say, well, see, there's no hyperinflation, everything's okay. And I think this is the image people have of their future. When you have a situation like that, you have to move aggressively to get the hell out of that room and to start creating an alternative. So I'd like to thank both of you. I think this has been a very useful discussion. And again, anyone who's listening, go to the LaRouche PAC website, take the tour, take your friends on the tour. It's probably the cheapest way to spend the last couple of weeks in August, given the spike in airline prices and hotel costs and things of that sort. So you can travel throughout the continental United States and on into Russia and elsewhere and do some good for your mind. So, Michael and Merv, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Okay, and this is another LaRouche Show. Join us next Saturday, 3 p.m. Eastern, and we'll take it from there.